Welcome to the Bicycle Media Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the health of the cycling industry.
Not a lot of people had that tone that just said, ride whatever bike you want to ride.
There's a couple of things about building a custom bike.
What these e-bikes can do.
It's quite hard for them to train when they don't know what they're training for.
I started to demystify things.
But if you don't have the right staff, that's game over.
You're not selling at that point, you're educating.
Big thanks to our coffee sponsors, Roasty, for all their support for the podcast. Make sure and check them out at roasty.ca. They've been delivering coffee to Edmontonians and deliver across Canada for orders over $40. Check them out. Big thanks, guys, as always. It's bike month, June 1st. Recording this one here in the morning. Working on some Roasty coffee, actually. Big thanks to the guests so far. Big thanks to everyone who's tuned in, subscribed, liked, sent comments. Had over 1,000 listens already. Not big numbers, but definitely happy with those. This guest is Adrian Emilson, someone who's had a lot of cool commentary on the industry through his social media, talking a little bit about old guards sending the olive branch down to the young guys, mentorship, the position at large, the longevity of being a bike mechanic. He doesn't fix bikes a ton, he just focuses mostly on building wheels, but we talk about his first 1,000 wheels, and of course, the sort of pressure that he has to build not only a quality wheel but a safe wheel. And then we also talk a little bit about the throwaway culture of the cycling industry, and I'll let him talk more about that. So really cool guy, definitely love speaking with him. That being said, here's my conversation with Adrian Emilson of Melody Wheels. Adrian, thanks for being on the call this morning for you and this evening for me.
Hey, Cody. It's great to be here, and thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed listening to your podcast, so yeah, great to speak.
So our listeners, you know, wide range of individuals from bike shop owners to event managers and brands, big and small. Maybe let's just give them a little bit of a background on yourself. And you know, I'm going to jam out on some of your background a little bit. But let's just start off by giving our listeners just a little bit about yourself and Melody Wheels.
Okay. Well, Melody Wheels is obviously a wheel building business. I guess the key goal of the business is excellence in wheel building. So my focus is trying to do the best quality workmanship in wheels possible. You know, and sometimes that's not always 100% achievable. You always work with the limitations of what you're working with. But yeah, the first thing is it's about excellence in wheel building. The second thing is I am focused on the state or the city that I live in, so in Perth and in Western Australia. I'm not a wheel brand. I don't have branded components. I don't send them in boxes across Australia or all over the wheel, all over the world, not the wheel. My focus is very much about being a specialist in my area and being able to help people with their specific problems. It's not about trying to create a new product and you know, make lots of them.
Yeah, and I mean, I know a little bit of your background as well, and your involvement in cycling came from, I understand, a PhD in geography, and you were doing some work that kind of led you to becoming involved in cycling and cycling advocacy. And that's a bit of a journey from being a custom wheel builder. So connecting those dots is is good to know. And people get into their industries and their vocation from different ways. So I'm excited to learn more.
Yeah, well, yeah. So, the background. Sorry, I missed that. I originally started as a town planner. I studied town planning for 5 years straight after school at university. I worked for a couple of years as a town planner, and then I went back to uni and started a PhD in geography, and that was sort of a progression from my planning. And I sort of thought that I was going in a kind of academic-y kind of world, and it was around that time that I got really interested in bikes. I was riding to uni every day. I picked up cycling as a sport, and I also became involved in a lot of cycling advocacy, and this is in Sydney, Australia, and that was a really exciting time to be working in cycling advocacy, because there was a bit of a sort of a momentum happening in terms of of bike planning and that kind of thing. Anyway, the long story is I never actually finished the PhD. I pulled out after a couple of years, which was really kind of a bit stressful and embarrassing at the time because, you know, if you do 3 years in a PhD, you're meant to finish it. But I kind of just lost interest. And, you know, all things considered, I don't have any regrets. I got a new passion. I got a new career, which I ended up straight after that working in bike advocacy and then in sustainable transport planning. And anyway, the long story is I did that for about 3 or 4 years, and it was just this really weird thing that happened where I was working for a cycling education company running all these bike ed programs, and I was only working 3 days a week, and I thought it'd be interesting to work as a bike mechanic. And I had a friend who ran a shop down the road, and I started working there, and I just absolutely fell in love with it. It was really weird. I think I'm that kind of that sort of person who's probably sat at a computer all their life and then sort of suddenly discovers working with their hands and just sort of really loves that sort of tangible outcomes focused aspect of work where you're not just sort of having meetings and writing emails all day. Not that I don't do that, but so that was the sort of weird sort of shuffle into the bike world. So I started training when I was 30, at the age of 30, as a mechanic. So I was sort of mid-career mechanic, and I need to be straight up. I don't consider myself a bike mechanic anymore. That was 10 years ago. I consider myself a wheel builder. Obviously, I know how to fix a lot of bikes, but in terms of skills progression, I've only had probably about 3 years of work in the shop, and then I pretty much went on to become a wheel builder by mistake, and that was just one of those things that happened weirdly. I really loved wheel building when I started working as a mechanic. And I started building wheels in the shop. I started building wheels for people in my cycling club. And a couple of years later, I moved cities, and I'd sort of had this, you know, interest in wheel building, and I just sort of kept running with it. And I'd always dreamed about maybe starting a wheel building shop, but it was only when I was really sort of pushed I did it. And I gave myself a year to start out, and I said, if it doesn't work after 1 year, I'll just quit and try something else, and I survived, and that was back in 2014. So I've been operating 6 years since. Yeah,
I guess with sustainable transport planning, and you know, I'm in Alberta. There's a lot of snow that covers the roads. There's also a lot of gargantuanly large pickup trucks that dominate the roads. We are in what we call oil country. And the advocacy and planning that has gone into our city don't match, and that we have well-to-do individuals that want to improve cycling, and it can be challenging in minus 30, minus 40 with windshields. But we also have a at-large motorist community that loves to honk their horns and drive close enough where you can smell their, you know, air freshener hanging in from the rearview mirror. You know, was it frustrating to be in, you know, cycling advocacy and transport planning, knowing that decisions made by forefathers didn't really, you know, accommodate cycling?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to be a transport advocate, cycling advocate, you kind of have to have the patience of a saint. And I think one of the reasons why I became more interested in both bike education and in mechanics was because I was really drawn to the tangibility in terms of getting that sort of sudden success, you know, outcome. It is really hard work doing planning advocacy work because you are sort of set up with a whole lot of constraints and limitations, and often a lot of cultural and sort of social values issues. So people with power in large organisations, be them government or various institutions, it can be really hard getting runs on the board or being taken seriously when you're trying to advocate for cycling.
I agree. You talked about tangibility. You talked about being stuck at a computer. My music career, my education career, and my graphic design and digital media career means I am a lifelong screen person. A friend of mine posted something regarding digital dementia and this idea that one's proprioception begins to dwindle from simply staring at a screen day in and day out. So when you say you really felt some, personal value in creating something with your hands, I truly relate to that. But the life of a bike mechanic and a wheel builder is much more arduous and can be less enjoyable. In one of your recent stories, you talked about the longevity of the bicycle service and building profession, and maybe that there isn't enough of that mentorship. Can you kind of go into what you meant a little bit by that?
Sure. Bike mechanics is generally not seen as a profession or a trade. A lot of people come into it because they love bikes, but they don't necessarily get the sort of mentorship both on the job or in other forms of training to really develop as a mechanic. And the time to, to become, skilled in the profession, it takes years to get on top of everything, whether it be the latest SRAM, group set, or dealing with some weird French thing from the 1950s that no one's ever seen before. there's this huge pile of knowledge that's required to be able to problem solve and fix people's problems. However, the point that I was making on that Instagram post was that within Australia, at least, and it's probably similar in a lot of other places, bike mechanics are classified in the same sort of skill category as people who collect shopping trolleys at the supermarket. And that's not to say that that's not important work, but generally the problem we have is that we generally don't value mechanics skills too highly, and the problem that generates is that people just don't hang around in the industry because they're busting their ass to get things done and to fix things, and they're still getting paid pretty much at the sort of lowest skill level possible. Whereas in other industries, be it, say an electrical trade or auto mechanic, there is an apprenticeship program. There are standards of skills and qualifications, and there are generally more opportunities for career progression, which both involve better pay but acknowledgement of one's skills. It's a really tough industry, and the thing that I've observed, so I'm in my early 40s now, and the thing I've observed from being around at least a decade is that a lot of people do it when they're young and they love it, but when they get older, it just grinds them down. For me, when I started my business, I was working 6 days a week. And that was because I needed to be open on weekends as well as the weekdays. And, it just meant that when you have young family, it's very, very hard to actually find the time, and you're not really earning the money to make up for that either.
Yeah. I think that's the gist of it that I got. And it's sad because we now... Well, in COVID-19, the bicycle has found its time to shine, and the bicycle mechanic is probably still not given the respect where the customer's coming in and saying, well, my local gym my local gym closed, or I'm stuck on the trainer, but I need this bike fixed and I need it done now. And I don't want to pay you much to do it. And there's that mechanic that doesn't want to put out garbage work, that, like you said, loves what they do, but is pretty much being taken advantage of. You know, you also addressed mentorship in the cycling industry, and I'm sure that can be hard because as this is a business, somebody that lives in a city can't necessarily go and get mentorship from somebody because now that mechanic who's, or sort of the mentee, is now perhaps a competitor. And as you alluded to, sometimes shops would rather, you know, poach a mechanic that's trained rather than bring one in and train them up. But, you know, you yourself, you've gone through, and even though you don't necessarily consider yourself a mechanic, you certainly did UBI in Portland and got various certifications. You continued probably grow your knowledge as new things related to wheels come through. But what's your advice to somebody, be it, you know, a career change or a young buck looking to move up and become a mechanic? What's your advice to them in terms of getting mentorship and education and then staying through the grind until their fingers no longer want to hold a hex wrench?
Well, I guess what I would say is, and it might sound a little flippant, but social media gets a really bad rap because it's seen as sort of attention seeking and narcissistic and all that sort of things. But there's just like thousands and thousands of people out there who share your quirky interest in bikes, and a lot of them are incredibly skilled and knowledgeable. And for me, not working in a traditional shop, I've reached out to a lot of people online through social media, and that's just been this incredible way of asking questions and learning and developing those insights into different things, because no one can be an expert at everything. So I would say that, you know, finding people who share your interest, who are willing to talk and are generous with their knowledge is a really good way to go forward for anyone sort of starting out. I do think I have to, you know, do a big shout out to UBI and other trade schools. I think it is worth going to a trade mechanics school if you can. What I think was most important about my experience at UBI was it didn't teach me everything, but it taught me a lot of the fundamentals, the theoretical conceptual background of mechanics, which allowed me to go on and work stuff out myself at some level. And a lot of cases, I'm not the kind of person who came from a, you know, household where people pulled cars apart and dad taught me things. My dad's a professor of religion, so he's about as non-mechanical as they get. So there's a lot of really basic concepts that come from having a formal teaching program in bike mechanics. So I'd highly recommend making the effort to do that. It's hard in Australia. I think there's a school that's recently opened, but there aren't as many certainly as there are in the US. And I've obviously heard of your, is it the Bike Room in Vancouver?
Yeah. Previous podcast guest, Jeffrey Bryson in Vancouver. And I mean, you know, we talked about maybe the trade, you know, not being a, you know, red seal trade, but he again is teaching you the overall concept, not necessarily how to do the individual task, which is, I think, is what you're kind of getting at with UBI.
Exactly. Yep.
Awesome. In another post, you put a photo of your bookshelf, which is there in your shop, and it's got a lot of tech documents. And you talked about, you said something, and I love sort of the stance you take on the industry throughout your posts. And you talked about perhaps how the industry does not care for the products they make over their lifespan and that underlying throwaway culture of cycling. It's what's the latest and greatest, or, you know, this group set doesn't work for me, I'm going to chuck it. Can you talk a little bit about how you fight against that and your appreciation for it? It's one of the things I love about you is it's about fixing something and repairing it rather than chucking and replacing. Can you talk a little bit about the longevity of products and how you save them from the dumpster?
Sure. Well, with the wheels, so I repair a lot of wheels, and it's really unfortunate that one of the reasons I got into custom wheel building in general was just this belief that we could make stuff that was better quality and that could actually have a genuine service life, that it could be repaired and looked after. A lot of the wheels that I work with from the big brands are what they call proprietary wheels. So they require very specific components, and that you have to have those exact components to make the wheel work. However, if something breaks, which happens, that component may only have been made for 1 year, and then they change the model the next year, and then the year after that. So you end up sort of searching, trying to find all these random small parts that no one stocks anymore. So you end up, you know, it might just be a really simple thing like a spacer, but you don't have a spacer and you can't fix this old wheel because it's broken or something's happened. So that's a real challenge, I think, with the industry. It does feel like a lot of the time we just sort of treat bicycles and bike components as disposable. And I think, yeah, it's frustrating because obviously if you're a mechanic, you want to keep things working and being looked after and address some of those sort of waste issues. And I feel that a lot of it really comes down to the design. A lot of the times the industry wants to appear with something that's new and different, and that desire to be new and different often means coming up with these sort of radical designs that don't always sort of think about whether they're going to be fixable, serviceable in a few years down the track.
I think you have absolutely the right, and it probably is the same thing for a lot of other components within the bicycle industry. 1,000 wheels. When you look back at building your first 1,000 wheels, how have things changed from wheel one to 1,000?
Wheel one, I was still cutting my teeth, obviously. I think building my first 1,000 wheels really gave me an appreciation of all of the different types of challenges that involve working with different types of wheels. So I build everything from e-bike wheels for electric mobility scooters through to top-end racing, road, track, mountain bike wheel sets and everything in between. And the way you go to approach a wheel, some of the design considerations involved in that really vary in terms of the type of wheel and what its sort of intended purpose is. The other thing is, I think, in that sort of first 1,000 wheels is that most wheel builders would describe themselves as having some kind of process. You follow these steps and this is the recipe, and you do this, you know, consistently, and you get this outcome. And one of the things that happens in your first 1,000 wheels is you really refine your process and work out, you know, exactly what you think works the best, what are the best approaches, what are the best ways for stress-releasing spokes, what are the best thread-locking applications, those sorts of issues. You know, how do you make sure that your measurements are really precise when you're calculating your spoke lengths, those sorts of things. So a lot of refinement improvements, and it's actually something I still really struggle with, even though I've actually lost count of how many wheels I've built, be at least 3,000 or 4,000. But it's I still struggle with wanting to improve my processes and innovate in different ways, but then you don't want to mess up the recipe too much, so to speak. So it's a real challenge trying to get that balance. But yeah, as I say, the first 1,000 wheels is really I'd say it's just sort of refining your process primarily.
Previous podcast guest, she's team mechanic for Liv. She's a student of the Bike Room. And I asked her about, you know, women in cycling and what we need to do more of, or things she's learned. She said, you know, I've started to demystify wheel building, and a lot of teachers have made it seem to be more complicated than it is. And she went on to say that she builds wheels very organically. She's not one to have the latest and greatest, you know, Italian gauges on her truing stand. And so I said, so you're pretty much an organic builder versus sort of the more technical, detailed wheel builder. And she said, yep, that's me. How would you rate yourself? Are you very much about getting everything perfect as you hand the customer the wheel, or is it more about letting them ride it out and then bringing them back to tweak things? I mean, she literally could probably have a cold beer and everything she needs by the edge of Vancouver Ocean, and she'd go for it. But how do you approach wheel building with respect to your process and being exact? I mean, because you talked about it, over 1,000, now 3,000 wheels, your process is somewhat dialed in, and there's probably not very many revisions you make.
Yeah. Listen, I probably am more at the kind of obsessive OCD end of the spectrum. The comparison I would make, I guess, between approaches is that 90% of what I do, I could probably do in half the time in terms of building a wheel. But it's that 10% extra that probably takes an additional double the time. So I sort of get that, and I understand that, being kind of a perfectionist may not sort of be sort of what everyone wants to achieve in terms of wheel building. It's really possible to build great wheels quickly that are fit for purpose. But I think just having this at the center of my business, I don't really want to take shortcuts. I want my work to be the highest possible. And I think it's possibly a selfish thing as well, but I mean, it's actually just what motivates me, doing things better. I'm motivated to do things quicker as well. And I've spent a lot of time trying to improve my processes so I can do stuff quicker without losing any quality. But at the end of the day, when you're dealing with all these like really little sort of small tasks, like, you know, deburring the inside of a rim, calculating and measuring every hub, even though you've measured them 100 times before, but just to make sure that there's no irregularity, making sure that all the contacts and parts of the wheel are lubricated, putting spoke preps on that require a 12-hour time period to cure, documenting your work at the end of it so you've got exact records of everything that you've done. All that stuff kind of adds time, and you could probably do it in half the time, but for me, I had a customer come in the other day. He had a spoke break. Yeah, I admitted it, a spoke break on one of my wheels, but it was about 4 years old, and I was like, okay, that's fine. We can fix it. And I had his details from when I built his wheel. I knew to the fraction of a millimeter what the spoke length was. So, you know, all those things come into they're of value to me. So, yeah, I guess that's it. You know, there's different ways of doing things, and I don't disregard people who don't want to follow the process that I've necessarily gone down.
Yeah, my next question is about, then what is the perfect custom wheel customer? Because that is somebody who wants something unique and something special. In previous conversations, our frame builder from Rollingdale talked about a customer that is more relationship built versus transactional. I think you would agree. Somebody who receives your documentation about the tension of every wheel spoke probably is that customer that says, this is my guy. You need wheels built and you're in the area. you gotta go see Melody Wheels. Talk about your perfect customer, or just, the customers that you see most often that wants that hand-built wheel.
Yep. I think you sort of, you nailed it in the sense that, my customers maybe are a little bit like myself in some respects, in the terms of they're a little bit more on the obsessive side of the spectrum. So someone who obviously loves cycling, someone who's not necessarily concerned with having the the best and greatest or the lightest, but someone who appreciates good workmanship and quality. So those are the sort of key, some of the key aspects. And I think at some level also shares some of those values. So as I mentioned earlier, the idea of a wheel being serviceable, repairable, having components of good integrity, those sorts of things are generally going to appeal to one of my customers, because they're not just looking for the lightest or the cheapest thing that can arrive in a box the next day. I'd say otherwise, I think being pragmatic at some level, a big thing that I try to give to my customers is a sense that I don't sort of say that, you know, this hub is necessarily better than the other. It's more about understanding the differences between them. So what's important for them is more of a question than rather than me trying to describe to them what I think they should have. So for some people, you know, they really want their wheels to be beautiful because they want their bikes to be beautiful, and I'm really cool with that. That's fine. Other people, it's just like, I need something that doesn't break. And it's just like, you know, I was super chuffed when I had a customer come in the other day with some wheels. I hadn't seen him for 3 years, and he said, these are the only wheels that have never broken. And he's, you know, usually 6 months out of a set of wheels before something goes wrong. So there's different needs. And as I say, I'm not trying to sell the Kool-Aid and say, like, you know, buy a set of my wheels and suddenly you're going to start winning bike races or any of that. So I think when people have that kind of trusting, pragmatic approach, then generally we sort of, you know, we'll get along. At some level, I kind of hope for patience. The problem of being custom is you're doing everything one at a time, and we're used to a world where stuff arrives straight away instantaneously, and unfortunately custom takes a bit more time. My lead-in times are usually sort of around 2 to 3 weeks for a new wheel. So patience is really helpful. But yeah, I think that mostly covers it.
Could we talk a little bit about what it's like to see somebody, perhaps on a televised race event or following them, the career of somebody on your wheels that's also a professional cyclist? Can you talk a little bit about that and just knowing that they're on a pair of wheels that is safe on a descent at 100 kilometers an hour?
Well, I can't say a professional, but I've had my wheels raced at national championship levels. One of the things that happens is in, you know, there are certain parts of a race where riders might travel at up to 100 k's an hour. And when you're building a wheel, you know, you think about the consequences of what would happen if a spoke were to break at that speed, and, you know, anything's possible. But it just sort of reinforces the seriousness of what I'm doing. You know, it's often wheel building can be seen as a hobby that you just sort of throw stuff together, but there's a huge responsibility in doing it and doing it right. So for me, I always think about those extreme examples when I'm building a wheel that it's, you know, this isn't a hobby. This is something that needs to be done to a really, really high standard, because, you know, I don't want to say it flippantly, but people's lives are at stake, you know. their control of their bicycle needs to be done with a safely made wheel, you know. So
I agree. And bikes got to look beautiful. I'm in sales and marketing of bikes, and they are beautiful to look at and beautiful to sell. How can people follow you and stay in tune? And if they are in your neck of the woods with some change in their pocket and a few weeks to hang around, how can they dial in and get a set of wheels, be it good climbing wheels or just something for a local crit?
My best way to find me is probably through my website, which is melodywheels.com. wheelbuilding.com.au. I'm also on all the usual social media, Facebook and Instagram. Not a big Facebook user, but relatively active on Instagram. So yeah, my Instagram is just at Melody Wheels. That's pretty much it. I'm based in just outside of Fremantle, which is a sort of a second city of Perth, or a port city inside of Perth. And yeah, you can come and see me at my workshop anytime. Thank you.
Big thanks to Adrian for his time. Up next is Tim Travis. Now, he's the founder of the Toolbox Wars, but also does a fair bit of wrenching. He's actually training the police, as I understand, in Korea. And we talked about Toolbox Wars. The exercise there is uncovering something that's already there. It's something that happens occasionally, and it's kind of like finding gold. Companies will pay advertising agencies for campaigns to do various things, and to some degree there is, of course, success, but to go viral or to have this cultural movement, you really need to uncover something that's already there. And Tim, he did that. Understanding that people love toolboxes, and that these smaller toolboxes that are put together by race mechanics for traveling is something that the amateur wrencher is going to be interested in, and that there's been this whole movement around it, and people are cutting foam and, you know, gluing magnets and searching the ends of the world for tool clips. But really cool guy that talked a lot about the industry and certainly what he's doing with Toolbox War. So excited to have a conversation that was recorded quite a while ago. So some of the social media stats are kind of out of date, but just kind of the flow of the podcast release schedule. And yeah, so again, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for your comments. Really do appreciate everything. And again, check out Bicycle Media at liftvalet.com/bicycle. Again, we're here for all of your digital marketing. So be it web design, SEO, video production, email marketing, you name it, we're here. So tune in for the next one, guys. Talk soon.